Matter of Green Knight Capital versus Gabriel Calderon. May we please have appearances?
Morning. My name is Keith Bocci. I'm the attorney for Green Knight Calderon. Behind me is my partner, Elvin Monser. He works for.
Good morning, Justice. This is Stephen McNally, McNally Bellino, on behalf of the intervener, 133 73rd Street, LLC.
May it please the Court, Your Honors. Good morning. Adam Greenberg, Hodigan Greenberg, appearing for Amicus National Tax Lien Association.
Good morning. Alan Polliner for Amicus New Jersey Land Title Association.
Good morning and welcome, counsel. Mr. Bunchy, please. And I should tell everybody, Justice Solomon will be participating. He's going to be reviewing the material, the argument. Please go ahead.
Mr. Chief Justice, is it allowable to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal?
How about three?
Three, okay. May it please the Court. This is a case about statutory interpretation. My criticism of the final panel on the appellate division is that if you read the Green Knight decision, nowhere are the two applicable statutes cited at any point. And the statutes are very clear, unlike apparently the prior oral argument where it's a convoluted statute. We deal with two statutes, NJSA 54:5-98 and NJSA 54:5-89.1. And 54:598 starts off, after the complaint has been filed, redemption shall be made in the cause only or in the case. I don't think there's any ambiguity as to what that means. And when you run into an issue and you have to make a motion to intervene, we go to NJSA 54:5-89.1, and about four lines from the bottom of the statute, when you take a motion, you file a motion to intervene, it says after filing of the complaint. Those two are the key terms. For those of you who didn't have the privilege of sitting general equity, we're doing a tax sale foreclosure in your life, I just want to briefly explain the procedure. We file a complaint, we serve, we default. Usually takes about 11, 12 months. And at the end of the last 3 months, we file a motion and we get an order setting the last day to redeem, commonly referred to as an OST. It's 60 days out, and if no one redeems, we apply for final judgment. The appellate division panel rewrote the statute to say only in the last third of the foreclosure, the last 3 months, does this NJSA 54:5-98 apply? And as I said, there's really no lack of clarity as to the statute. When I was back in 2006 and I argued Simon versus Kroniker, please remember there were three cases, Simon versus Kroniker, Simon versus Randall, Malinowski versus Jacobs. In that unanimous decision by the Supreme Court, Justice Albin wrote a long and thorough opinion in Kroniker, and his holding was, quote, we now hold that the tax sale law does not prohibit a third-party investor from redeeming a tax certificate after the filing of the foreclosure action. He specifically analyzed these two statutes very thoroughly through these opinions, and he clearly indicated that the key time was after the filing of the complaint. There's no ambiguity in his decision. At page 320, he says, after filing of the complaint, however, both the property sale and the redemption proceeds are subject to court supervision, which is where you have to make a motion to intervene, get approval of the judge, showing that at that time, more than nominal consideration. That, of course, was amended last November. I'll get into a second. So he was very clear, but he went on and he further stated at page 508, because those cases actually involve five fact patterns. And people have always been trying to get around the tax sale law, which is exactly trying to come up with a way to evade the clear mandate of these statutes. And Justice Albin said, we intend to interdict the myriad of machinations that a creative mind might devise to elude the tax sale law. And that's all. They did a nice job and they convinced the trial court and the appellate panel. But what they did was they eluded the clear language of the tax sale law, which clearly indicates that you have to file the redemption in the cause only. Now, I indicated before, the only change that's been to the law since 2007 decisions was the definition of nominal consideration was changed in November of 2021, Chapter 231 of the laws of 2021, replaced it with fair market value. That's the only change to the statute. And if the legislature wanted to say it only applied after the OSD, the order setting time, place, amount of redemption was entered, they could have said so, but they didn't. They have not changed the law. And also, this is only one type of foreclosure. There's three types of foreclosures that the tax sale law applies to. The one I just claimed, which is an in personam without a share sale. If there's a federal lien, you do an in personam with a share sale. There's no order setting time. You go to final judgment, you get a writ, and you have a share sale. You also have an in rem foreclosure. An in rem foreclosure, again, you get a complaint and you serve and you go to final judgment. There's no order setting time. So the appellate division decision creates confusion because what happens in those instances? But if you actually follow the clear black letter law of the legislature, there is no confusion. We all know what it means before the complaint is filed and after the complaint is filed. And as I said before, since 2007, it's worked very clear. There really hasn't been anything other than arguments over the definition of nominal consideration, which has been helped put my kids through college. It's been a lot of stuff and cases over the years, but that's been resolved by the legislature last year.
Mr. Bonci, suppose a party inappropriately tries to redeem the tax certificate by going to the municipality, but then before the entry of final judgment seeks to intervene in the underlying action. Is there anything in the statute or the case law that you can point us to that bars the attempt to intervene after that mistaken first step to accept your argument?
Well, there's two statutes that trigger. One is 54:5-98 saying you have to be in the cause, you have to be named as a defendant. As Justice Albin said in Chronicler, all the tax collector has to do is put the complaint down and see if they're named in there. There's another statute, NJSA 54:5-54, who says who can redeem. Only the owner of their heirs, a prior municipal tax certificate holder, a mortgagee, or an occupant. Occupant not being really a tenant, but if I lived there, you know, with a woman I didn't marry for 30 years, we would say they could redeem to save the property.
Suppose it's an appropriate individual who otherwise would have the authority to intervene. Can they come after the first faulty step?
Well, they would have to make a motion to intervene.
Right.
Because they're not named in the cause and prove their right to redeem. Now, in that instance, which really goes to my next argument, which is the constructive trust.
That happened here, right? That there was a complaint filed and eventually a motion to intervene before final judgment.
Well, yeah, after they try to redeem.
Isn't that all that the statute requires?
No. The statute requires you, before you try to redeem, to make a motion to intervene.
That's what I said. There was a... All right, so
they tried to redeem before
your problem here is that they attempted to redeem first before intervening.
Correct.
So but where in the statute...
I'm sorry.
Where in the statute does it bar the party from correcting its mistake and then coming back to the right forum and seeking to intervene?
Well, I'm going to go back to what I said before. The statute requires you to be named in the cause to intervene, and an owner, a contract purchaser, can intervene. So the question really is, can you get away, unless you're caught, can you get away with it? Because if you don't enforce it, as Justice Albin did in Chronicler, there's no difference between Cherry Stone Bay and the person attempted to redeem here. If in fact you don't do it, nobody's going to do.
Your adversary says that this is an arm's length transaction, and Chronicler was not in the Cherry Stone.
Yes, it was the same basic thing. Chronicler was the same basic thing. There was a third party who made a contract with the owner, and they attempted to come in. There was a contract in that case. There was a third party transaction. There's no question about it. It was paying $250,000 for the property in CL City. So it was absolutely, they would argue the same thing. It's an arm's length transaction. If in fact you can have an arm's length transaction when someone's being foreclosed.
But wasn't that part of the point in Chronicler was that this was not an arm's length transaction? The circumstances were of that contract were didn't suggest it was bargained for?
Well, I think I agree with you to point that anytime you're being foreclosed, and you have the pressure of a foreclosure, it requires judicial review. That's what the whole statutory scheme here is. So they all had to have a review by the court in order to make sure that the amount being paid was fair. And if you evade the process of judicial review, and then if you're caught, it's the only time you have to make a motion to intervene. We'll have no one making the motion because there's no penalty.
But your adversary also says that a distinction between this and Kronecker is that here there was no ST entered by the
right.
court.
Right. He's saying that because we weren't towards the end of the foreclosure and the OST was entered. But that's not what the statute says. Statute says after the complaint is filed. That's not what Kronecker says. And if I was arguing for a legislative committee to rewrite the statute, I would argue that when someone gets served with a complaint, they get just as upset as at the end of the foreclosure. So they have the same pressures on them. And the legislature was well within its right to say, after the complaint is filed, it has to go for judicial review.
Something that I did not understand from your submission is, are you saying there's a deadline for moving to intervene? And if so, what is the deadline?
Before the complaint, for the final judgment, after the complaint is filed, and before the final judgment is entered.
Would someone ever seek to intervene without a contract to purchase the property? I mean, it would make no economic sense, right, for interveners to just try to get involved in the case and then negotiate with the property owner, right?
That would be correct, unless somehow we missed somebody, you know, and there was a question as to whether they were an heir or not, and they would move in there. But as normally, these come up when people are purchasing either a mortgage or a fee title to the property.
So why wouldn't it be sensible to say that someone can move to intervene any time prior to the entry of final judgment, and that if they have a contract, that contract should not be implemented or enforced until the court reviews, now under the new 89.1, whether the proposed terms are for fair market value? Would that, in your view, be an appropriate way? You have a contract, you move to intervene, but you can't yet execute the contract until the court reviews it. Would that make a sensible interpretation of all these statutes?
As long as they do it before they attempt to redeem. I mean, the whole statutory framework is, before you attempt to redeem, you have to make a motion to intervene and get court approval. If you do it after you attempt to redeem, what you're trying to do is evade it, because we're not going to catch all of them. We caught this one. This is a guy who's no different than Cherry Stone Bay. He sent out PA 52 in the appendix, 300 letters a week to people getting foreclosed. This is the exact same issue. He's a competitor of Cherry Stone Bay. It's the same exact process. He's going after people who are being foreclosed, and these statutes were designed to force the people buying it, the respondent here, to file a motion before the court and lay out what's happening. If you say that once they're caught, there's no penalty, then there's no reason for them to make the motion. And Justice Albin was very clear at the end of Kronecker, and the constructive trust was not a remedy that he invented. The very first air hunting title rating case, Braun versus Weintraub, I think 1964, the remedy was constructive trust. Then in Wattles versus Palazzo, Illinois versus Continental Searchers, which the cases came in after that, the remedy again was a constructive trust. And then when Kronecker came down and Simon versus Rando, the remedy was constructive trust. We're not going to let someone who violates the law benefit from their wrongdoing.
Well, generally with a constructive trust, you need some sort of wrongdoing to be fraud or some similar wrongdoing. I mean, the main complaint here seems to be that the third party took the position that it need not intervene and didn't move to intervene. And that may or may not be a correct position, but that doesn't strike me as wrongful conduct.
Well, it is wrong. We have a statute that mandates that they make a motion to intervene. They evaded the statute. The remedy preserves the distressed property owner keeps their money. It doesn't affect them. It just doesn't allow someone who undermines the tax sale law to benefit from their wrongdoing. Here, they clearly did not follow the mandates. This was no mystery. 2007, three cases out. Almost in every policy I've seen from a title company, they require the consent of the lien holder or an order consent or relying intervention. Since the case came down in 2007, this is an area of law I practice every day. you know, a routine. Every week I get email from someone or title company, you know, the list pendants of records, so they know there's a foreclosure going on. Do you have an objection? I say, send me the contract. I send it to my client. Don't have a problem. Do you know how to consent order? We've been working out. But every once in a while, we find someone who, for whatever reason, they do it. Here, the reason was obvious. There was substantial profit to be made. And they got the profit. And if you don't enforce the constructive trust, there's no, they're just going to continue to do this, and there'll be no penalty for it. So the penalty that Justice Alpin put in, as did three prior Supreme Courts, they said you don't gain the benefit of undermining the whole public policy of the tax sale law. Remember, what this does is it protects not only the distressed property owners, but also protects the integrity of the tax sale, which is the key event to, we want people to go to the tax sale and bid against each other, which benefits distressed property owners by reducing the interest rate. And also, if you get down to zero, it goes to a premium to the municipality. That was a legislative scheme. So we're not saying that people can't do it. They just have to follow the law correctly. And if, and with all respect, if there is no penalty, there'll be no control. They'll be out there saying, what do I have to lose? If I get caught?
The penalty that you're seeking to be applied here, would that apply across the board?
No.
Both to entities that were trying to get one over, as you've suggested, as well as others who might have made an innocent mistake?
Well, there's a case out there called Phoenix versus Krupp, which shows a distinction. Judge Grawl had decided to publish an opinion. In that case, it was a close personal friend. And what Judge Grawl said, you have to make a motion to intervene. There's no getting around that. But we reserve whether the appropriate remedy to the trial court judge would be a constructive trust if it was a family member, a close personal friend. Remember, they're all exempt from the fair market value provision in 89.1. 89.1 says you have to have fair market value except where the transferee is related by blood or marriage, or who, because of a close or personal relationship with the transferor, would in normal course of a party instrument for little or no consideration. So the legislature made an exception. So let's say I innocently mistaken, and I'm not in there for a profit, and I give my nephew the property during a foreclosure, and they redeem the lien. Well, this statute would indicate that maybe in that situation, a constructive trust would not be the remedy. So I'm not arguing that you would apply it across the board, but when you have someone like Cherry Stone Bay, and the respondent is no difference out making a profit, they're not related to the family, they're not a niece or nephew, not a close personal friend. So I think Judge Grawl got it right, and she got it right in Simon versus Rando in the appellate division, that she was absolutely correct here in indicating that that's the type of difference. So I do agree that you would look to the facts of the case, but I don't agree that the respondent in this case is in fact any different than Cherry Stone Bay was in Simon versus Rando, Simon versus Kroniker, Malinowski versus Jacobs.
Seems like the statutory scheme is designed, once you file a foreclosure complaint, to allow the chancery judge to determine the equities in either allowing this party to redeem or not. Why is that enough to deal with the differences in facts that you're referring to in your argument?
Because the legislature, because respectfully, the panel here rewrote the statute. The legislature said that after the complaint is filed, you have to make a motion to intervene. That's what these two statutes say. It doesn't say after the OST. And they didn't.
Your argument seems to be motion to intervene before attempt to redeem, correct?
Exactly what Kroniker says, yes.
And not attempt to redeem. Oops, I didn't realize there was a foreclosure case. Now I'll move to intervene. You're saying that's that second circumstance is that rules out that party altogether?
Yes, because.
Forever.
Well,
and
again,
it's not a situation where the equity judge could say, oh, they made an innocent mistake. They weren't trying to pull any the wool over anybody's eyes, and it's equitable to allow them to purchase.
Let me show you. First of all, I made the exception of Phoenix versus Crew, where I said, well, if the person who was getting the property was a family member, a close personal friend, then the judge, the general equity judge, if you were back in Monmouth County sitting, you would have that discretion. But what you're doing is you're setting up a situation where we're going to be having trials in every case because everyone's going to say it was an innocent mistake. But look at the facts of the case. There's no issue that the respondent here was out to make a profit, and they did this to make a profit so that the lien holder would not get it.
But that might have also been of benefit to the former owner, or the soon-to-be former owner, correct?
But they get the benefit.
It was a legislative interest in adopting these statutes.
But the constructive trust remedy gives the prior owner the benefit that they had. It never takes it away. Justice Albin went out of his way to make sure he protected the distressed property owner with the remedy, and so did the prior Supreme Courts. They never, in Waddles or Braun versus Weintraub, never took away, and there is no harm to distressed property owner. The question here, quite simply, is, does someone who gets a swoop in at the last second, someone being foreclosed, and buys a property, we wouldn't be arguing here today if the property did not have substantially more value, get to take that benefit after he evades judicial review? So, and again, the legislature has come back and said to Your Honor, now when if you were somehow reassigned to general equity for a day and you had one of these cases, said the standard is fair market value now, and they've said that, but you have to have judicial review. If you don't have any penalty to violating the tax sale law and you're an entity that's out there simply to make a profit, you're not one of the exceptions in 89.1, then there's no control. Everyone will be doing this because there's no penalty for violating the law. And you'll not know about most of the cases because there won't be motions. So I respectfully submit that it isn't just up to the general equity judge to decide this. Once the complaint is filed, then you go under the statute and you determine whether they fall in an exception, whether fair market value is paid.
So what is the description of the circumstance, your description of the circumstances under which the court should impose a constructive trust?
Well, clearly when someone is simply a third-party investor, as Justice Albin called them in Simon versus Kroniker, out there to make a profit, he called them a commercial competitor to us, that those people don't get to benefit from violating the statute. They just simply don't. So I would just go back to what Justice Albin did in his well-reasoned opinion, where he says he viewed us as commercial competitors. I lost that issue because I didn't really think, I think people going to the tax sale are different, but he called them commercial competitors. I think people from going to the tax sale are investing in municipality, enriching the municipal treasury, that they have more public policy behind them than someone who swoops in at the last second. But he called them commercial competitors. I lost that issue. And clearly, these are commercial competitors, simply out for a profit. This would not be a situation, for example, I'll give you another example. My co-counsel had a case. This is a church that innocently loans money to someone to redeem a lien, a nonprofit church that's out to benefit people so they don't become homeless. I would not be contesting that one before you and hoping to win. That's another example of a fact pattern where I don't believe the appropriate remedy would be a constructive trust. But commercial competitors, yes.
What does that mean? Profit versus nonprofit? That's the test?
Part of it. I mean,
What else defines the
89.1 would be the language in there. If they're close personal friend, a family member would be in there. But for most of the times, if you're not, I would view exceptions to the rule, the general rule being you have to make that motion to intervene, and the remedy is going to be a constructive trust unless you're, quote, close personal family member related to blood, or somehow you show yourself to be an altruistic organization, not getting any profit for yourself, seeking to legitimately to help someone who's down on their luck, and they innocently violate the statute, as Judge Fisher would indicate, and you see that clearly in there. But they're going to be the only exceptions because, in this case, the fact pattern you have before you, there's no dispute. They're out there to make a buck. They're commercial competitors, Justice Albin would call them.
Mr. Bonci, I take it the amendment in 2021, changing nominal consideration to less than fair market value, has no impact on this appeal?
I don't think it has any impact on this case.
Other questions, anyone?
Thank you.
I have one more question. So I know in response to Judge Sabatino's question as to whether, you know, a party would seek to intervene before having a before closing or having a contract in place, it's normally not the situation. But if that were the case, that a party had not closed on the property and then after a failed attempt to redeem, filed a motion to redeem, would that also be a scenario where you would be looking for a constructive trust when the closing hasn't happened, and now the point of the statute and the case law that sale occurs under court supervision would be occurring under court supervision. Would that still be a scenario where you think a constructive trust?
Absolutely. And I'll explain to you why.
Why?
It's not so innocent what happens. We have situations where people advance money, and I have to put subpoenas on the banks to find the source of the monies, where they attempt to redeem, and they're attempting to evade the tax sale law. It happens several times a year. I have subpoena out, about to do a subpoena right now.
And when you say people, like the property owner advances money to?
If the property owner advances their own money, they don't need to make a motion to intervene.
Right.
There's no issue. If the property owner has a right to redeem at any time prior to the final judgment with their own money.
Right. What I'm saying is, are you referring to a property owner advancing money to a third party who's looking to purchase the property and hasn't yet intervened in the foreclosure action?
The reverse of that, where a third party advances money to the owner who goes in under the guise of his money.
Sorry. Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry.
The reverse of that is an attempt to evade the tax law. It happens several times a year in my office. I have one right now. Literally, I emailed the attorney. The check that came in, I have an heir who lives in Salem County, New Jersey, an attorney in Essex County. And somehow, the money came through his trust account, a trust check. I want to see the wire into his account. I want to see where the money came from. We run into these situations all the time. And again, it's a situation where you have to follow the law. This is not known. This is the law. There's 3 Supreme Court cases out on it, numerous appellate division cases out on this issue. The law is well known throughout the state. Title companies routinely put it in their policies that you need to get our consent. And all we're saying is follow it, because if you open the door, there's a lot of, ways of trying to evade this. And the whole point is not just for my client, but many times the properties are being sold under the old test substantially less than fair market value. And now with the fair market value standard, you're going to see more people trying to evade it, because it's many harder to obtain title without paying retail for it. So for all those reasons, I respectfully submit that Justice Alban was correct in his well-reasoned opinion, and that should remain the law. And the only ones who can change that law is the legislature, and they have not. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you for letting us argue this live rather than Zoom.
Happy to have you.
Yeah.
Mr. Greenberg.
Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices, may it please the Court. I want to thank you on behalf of the National Tax Lien Association for allowing us to be here today. The NTLA does not only represent tax lien investors. We also represent tax collectors and government officials, lenders, and servicers. We have a tax collector on our board of directors. We have a nonprofit foundation that raises funds to help struggling homeowners facing tax liens. We want the process to work for all involved, not just investors. If a property owner wants to save their home up until the last day the judgment is entered, God bless them, they can do that. What we want is clarity. My colleague, Mr. Polliner's brief says that the Land Title Association wants certainty of title. So do we. We absolutely want that. But what we want is certainty. We want to know what everyone's rights and obligations are. That's what Kroniker said. Kroniker said the tax collector need only look at the face of the complaint to determine who can redeem. The lien holder has their rights, and the investor has to do what they have to do. They have to file an intervention before tendering the redemption, period, after the filing of the complaint. It's not that tough.
Is there a deadline to that, or do you agree with Mr. Bonci that can be, the motion to intervene can be filed up to the day of the final judgment?
Absolutely. Matter of fact, back before Kroniker was decided, there were decisions that said that, where Cherrystone had filed motions practically the last day, sometimes even afterwards, even after the motion for judgment was filed. And the court said it's timely. If you're going to save your home, again, God bless you, do it. We're fine with that. That's what the law says. But we don't want the Wild West that existed before Kroniker. Kroniker had the unusual feature of direct certification. It was one of 5 combined cases that day that we argued. And why was it direct certification? Because it was a zoo down below. Our chancery judges were getting bombarded left and right. 20 years ago at 1 East Main Street in Freehold, in the Monmouth County Hall of Justice, we had Bay versus Spanish Fraternity and Savage versus Weissman. Both decided within a week by Judge Fisher. Both went on appeal, one published, one not. But we had percentages tests, we had formulas, who knows what else. We had no idea what one chancery judge was going to give us versus another. We had Judge Doyle, we had Judge Contillo, we had Judge Fisher. We had judges all over the state. We had no idea what we were going to get. We were getting bombarded, so were they. That's why this court took the case, all three of them, actually five of them, and it gave us certainty in three unanimous decisions. And Malinowski said, we do not announce today a new rule of law. Our decisions merely have construed provisions of the tax sale law in an unremarkable way. The appellate division the following year in an unpublished said, the Supreme Court dictates establish a bright line procedure for third party conduct in the circumstances presented. Yep, exactly. So what changed? Absolutely nothing. We have two statutes that have not materially changed, but for consideration, which is a different issue. Why did the outcome change? This court said, provided the parties comply with the dictates of the tax sale law and other relevant laws, this court is loath to intervene. We agree. Problem is, what do you do when they did violate that law? Now, I know my colleague argues about constructive trusts and the history of and what have you. But 60 years ago, this court decided that constructive trust was the proper remedy. In 1967, it did it again. 15 years ago, it did it again. The question is not why constructive trust may or may not be okay in certain situations. The question is, why should this court revisit 60 years of precedent and change the remedy that it decided? But what a lot of people don't realize is, just like traffic tickets and car accidents, foreclosures are data mined. It used to be there'd be people sitting on the sixth floor pulling the information out as it was filed. Now they sit at home on e-courts and they pull it out. And as soon as they do it, they start sending out letters. This gentleman sends out 300 a week. These are the letters I found at a Cherry Hill property from lawyers. Brochures, whatever, one even by postcard, which we know is pretty unethical, but that doesn't stop them. They do it. The same house. These are the ones that came into that house from property investors. We buy houses very fast. Stop foreclosure, dead. Don't pay for repairs, sell to us. They're pink, they're yellow, they're blue. They're all over the place. The nonsense that we go through, that your honors never get to see. Dorothy Jankowski, pursuant to an investor's urging, filed a motion to vacate the foreclosure on her Lenoka Harbor home, which was very impressive because it was 10 years and 1 month after she was buried at the Veterans Cemetery in Wrightstown. But that didn't stop her from filing a motion to vacate the foreclosure on her house.
Mr. Greenberg, all these examples of attempts to contact the property owner, if coming back to the scenario that I suggested to Mr. Bonci were followed, or that there is contact and there's a negotiation, an effort to offer to buy the home or even a contract, but not one implemented yet, can't the investor then at that point appropriately, before closing, move to intervene and the judge will evaluate whether it's for fair market value? So all the solicitation that you're talking about as pernicious would be allowed, wouldn't it, in that scenario?
Well, it's subject to judicial review, certainly.
But there's nothing wrong with them reaching out to the property owner to see if they can, you know, provide a better deal, is there?
Provided the parties comply with the law, there's nothing wrong with it.
And that means don't redeem yet, have everything else in place, and then move to intervene and let the court figure it out, right?
Correct. There's an unpublished decision, SMIC versus Dedzik. One of the interesting things is 89.1 has the word after one has acquired, past tense, the interest, meaning at that point they have the right to redeem. So under the case law, you could file a motion to intervene, and you could be granted intervention, but you cannot actually redeem until you've acquired the interest and paid more than whatever sufficient consideration should be. The point is that in this case, they tendered redemption. And they did that without intervention. That's what this court said was wrong. As another example, I have another one out of Hudson County, Helen Thornton.
Mr. Greenberg. We're not at the trial court level.
Please, I understand.
Don't introduce cases that are not in our record and unable for parties to respond to.
I understand. The point is, people do front the money for these cases. And if you'll give me 10 seconds. On Friday, I ordered a case where the guy came in with $72,000 in cash in a shopping bag in Camden City. This happens all the time. The point is, provided the parties comply with the dictates of the law, the court won't intervene. This court provided a bright line test. It said, by forbidding an interested investor from indirectly seeking redemption, we intend to interdict the myriad machinations a creative mind might devise. Why didn't they intervene? They had a lawyer. They had a title company. I've seen the title commitments. They say flat out what they need to do. But some of them circumvent us, and we don't find out until after the fact. And that's the problem here. Simply follow the law. So the owner's not harmed. This court said unanimously, neither will we permit the property owners to suffer. We conclude that the appropriate remedy is to impose constructive trusts. It wasn't a new rule of law in 2007, and the law hasn't changed. That outcome should not have changed either. We have every right of a property owner to save their property. But when it comes down to tax sales, our clients, our investors, all these servicers, they put a boatload of money into our towns. Cherry Hill collected $9.8 million in 5 hours at last year's tax sale. They put this money out for years and years and years, and somebody sends 300 letters a week to go chase down property owners. The least they can do is follow the same law that we are following. If we're doing it right and they're doing it wrong, they should not be permitted to benefit. I thank your honors. If there are any questions, I'm happy to address them.
Thank you, counsel.
I thank you. Take care.
Mr. McNally.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. May it please the court. This matter before this court involves an arm's length transaction whereby the intervener purchased property from an informed buyer before intervening in the tax foreclosure actions. Facts which are remarkably different from Kroniker. Adversary indicates that this, or suggests that this is the same as the circumstances in Kroniker. It's not. It's vastly different. When I say arm's length transaction, I mean you have two informed, sophisticated buyers and sellers who have their own leverage and can protect their own interest, rather than the circumstances that the court was concerned about when they were addressing Kroniker. There's nothing nefarious about the transaction in this matter. Notwithstanding the marked differences between this case and Kroniker, plaintiff and amicus asked this court to interpret that case to apply a one strike and you're out rule. If a purchaser fails to intervene before its first attempt to redeem a tax sale foreclosure certificate in a foreclosure action, they insist on this position regardless of the type of transaction involved or the type of purchaser. Plaintiff and amicus claim that if it's an arm's length purchase, as it was in this case, this draconian rule must be applied. If it involves a family with small children moving cross-country, the court has no discretion. It must bar redemption and pose a constructive trust, says the plaintiff and amicus. The plaintiff and amicus argue that the trial court should have no discretion in imposing a constructive trust. They maintain this position, notwithstanding the fact that the Kroniker decision does not mandate a constructive trust in all instances. Additionally, neither the court rule nor the pertinent statutes or the legislative histories mandate a constructive trust. Nowhere in those can you find a requirement mandating a constructive trust. Even more importantly, equitable considerations do not require such a holding, and the proposed rule would impose unnecessary hardships on purchasers. Despite this, plaintiff and amicus argue that if you fail to intervene before first attempting redemption, you are forever barred. While their argument may make sense in the context of the facts in Kroniker, where an air hunter purposely avoided judicial scrutiny, because after all, that's what the court is focused on. The court is focused on judicial oversight. If, in fact, there's going to be a transaction where they have this concern where third-party investors could exploit, you need to be able to go in court and have that judicial scrutiny. But that did happen in this case. The only issue that is different is that there was an innocent mistake that was made. It does not make sense to oppose this when the failed attempt at redemption was by mere oversight or ignorance of the law, as occurred here. Let's keep in mind, in this particular case, neither the buyer or the seller were the ones that were involved in the redemption process. The individuals who were involved in the redemption process in this was the attorney that represented Mr. Calderon, who was the owner of the property, and the title agent. Those were the individuals who were responsible for it. And there was no dispute, in fact.
There was three certifications submitted to the trial court in support of the fact that the transaction was not the type of transaction the court was concerned about in Kroniker. They were unchallenged. They didn't challenge the fact that this is a transaction entirely different from the one that was intended to be protected against in Kroniker. If the court rejects plaintiff's proposed draconian interpretation, no prejudice is visited upon the tax sale certificate holders. They still get the benefit of their investors' investment with a return as high as 18%. Because we also have to remember that after the trial court allowed for redemption in this matter, they didn't walk away with their hands empty. They actually got what they intended to get, which was they got the interest that they expected to get when they go into these to redeem. In considering whether the Kroniker court intended a one-strike rule, one must understand the background of the case. There, the court sought to address the competing interests of tax sale certificate holders and a particular type of purchaser described as third-party investors, air hunters, or intermeddlers. The court expressed that the focus was on protecting property owners from exploitation. That's why there needs to be judicial oversight. There was judicial oversight in this particular case. Braun versus Weintraub provides the best example of an exploitative air hunter in which the third-party investor sought out the heirs, paid them $400 for an interest in property worth almost $20,000, and did so by what the court described as a palpably deceptive letter. So we do have, that's the easy case. That's the one where we said, well, that's easy. Of course you should have a constructive trust applied in that particular case. But then you also have the opposite end of that. And the one where you have the family that is moving across country. They don't know anything about tax sale law when it comes to New Jersey. That's why they hire an attorney. That's why they hire a title agent. They are the ones that are ultimately going to be responsible. This family who is moving across the country, they don't have any involvement. But if in fact the amicus and plaintiff have their way, they will be barred, the redemption will be barred, and more importantly, they don't have a house to live in. Because again, according to them, it's a one strike and you're all, and it applies under all scenarios. Admittedly, bad actors and bad motives should not be rewarded, and constructive trust should be imposed in those instances. However, innocent buyers, the subject of honest mistakes, usually not their own, but rather professionals retained by them, should not be punished with such a harsh remedy. Second chances are appropriate. The Kroniker case simply does not create a universal rule imposing a constructive trust in all instances. And for that reason, the discretion can and should be left with the trial court, which is in the best position to decide if such a remedy is appropriate. That's exactly what the trial court did in this instance and took into consideration the facts reinforcing an arm's length purchase. As an example, Mr. Calderon, the owner of the property, is the one that reached out to Mr. Abreu. It didn't go the other way around. Additionally, the price was negotiated. We started with a $140,000 price. The price was the one that was set by Mr. Calderon, the owner of the property. It was only negotiated down to $100,000 when it was realized that we had a recalcitrant tenant that wasn't going to leave. And this was during the period where we were in a pandemic. No evictions were occurring. So there was a legitimate reason for the reduction. But again, this was between two parties that were able to protect their own interests. And moreover, both of them had attorneys that were representing them in this transaction.
Now let's stop the clock there, Mr. McNally. They negotiate, there's offer, counteroffer. They're down to $100,000 as the agreed upon price. What would be problematic or burdensome to say at that point, then it's incumbent on the would-be purchaser before completing a closing and before presenting something for redemption to move to intervene? What would be problematic with saying at that point you have a deal, you have a number, you have a contract, you got to go to court now?
There's nothing wrong with that, but the issue isn't necessarily whether or not you need to do that, because one thing is very clear. We're not arguing that there isn't a need to intervene. What we're saying is that there, in some instances, we need to allow a second chance where a mistake is made. So, Justice, I am not disagreeing with the one thing that they seem to think we are, that intervention isn't necessary after the filing of the complaint. Without question, it's necessary after the filing of the complaint. That's not the issue before this court. The issue is before the court is what happens if, in fact, you attempt to, you redeem, but you didn't file the motion to intervene. Do you get to go back and have a second chance? The answer can and should be yes.
Well, if you're guaranteed a second chance, wouldn't that create this, you know, in skewed incentives, though, to evade the law? Because there's no downside in not following the process correctly.
Justice Sabatino, I would suggest that it, in fact, is just one factor that the trial court should be considering when it makes a determination that a constructive trust should be imposed. As I mentioned, we have extremes. We have Braun versus Weintraub, which is the easy one. Clearly a constructive trust should be imposed. Then we have the other instance where you have a family that's moving across it. They're innocent. They don't know anything about this process. That's why they hire the attorneys in the trial courts. You have varying degrees. And how's the best way to deal with these varying degrees? You have the court analyze the facts. Make it determine that based upon those facts, is this the case that a constructive trust should be imposed? Because after all, that's exactly what the trial court did. They did exactly that. And frankly, it made a lot of sense. They analyzed all of the facts and they said, based upon this, and actually took it side by side with the law pertaining to constructive trust and said, this isn't it. This isn't where we a constructive trust should be applied. Because after all, we don't know why the court in Simon versus Crowder ultimately concluded that a constructive trust should be imposed, because there is no analysis in that case. And I would suggest that one of the reasons, first off, it certainly could have been because of the fact that we had a third-party investor who was purposely trying to avoid the judicial oversight. That certainly could have been one of the reasons. The other reason could have been is the fact that in fact, the court wasn't analyzing timeliness. I had indicated in my appeal briefs that everyone at the, if you read the case, and in fact you read the briefs that were submitted, the contention was the OST was the deadline. It was, and no one ever refuted that point. If you read the case, and again, I provided the trial briefs that were submitted by Mr. Bonchi and that, it continually it would say OST is the deadline. And therefore, the court could very well have come to the conclusion that since the deadline has already passed for redemption, this is a situation where a constructive trust is appropriate. In this situation, and that's why it was appropriate for the appellate division to say there is a difference in this case, and that is because the OST hasn't passed yet. And there's value to upholding the appellate division's decision. Why? Because of the fact that it allows parties to modify their behavior and, in fact, set expectations. I'll give you an example of where that will come into play. You have a situation, again, applying their one strike and you're out rule. You have a situation where they do a title search and the Liz pendants doesn't come up. They get to the day of closing and the Liz pendant shows up that day, but they don't pick up on what's described as a bring down. Bring down is the search that they do immediately before it, hoping to pick up everything to make sure that there isn't there. If you follow their reasoning, because of the fact that the complaint had already been filed and the Liz pendant was filed, you're once again out of luck because of the fact that you didn't pick up on it. Notwithstanding the fact that you could not have known about it until literally the day of closing, and likely you wouldn't even have known it in that instance. So if in fact you allow if you accept the appellate division's analysis as well, that sets a bright line. It's the OST date. If it's the OST date, a party to it can go look at the docket and see, well, I know that the OST date hasn't been set, and therefore I know that I still have time to redeem that, to intervene and redeem. If in fact you look at it and it's finished, you know, I can't do anything about this. I need to walk away from this transaction. So there is value in what the appellate division did in this case. And I do believe that that's what the appellate division intended. They wanted to set a bright line, and that they want certainty. There is certainty for you. In every instance, we know if, in fact, that OST hasn't been set, you can intervene.
Doesn't the court rule contradict that?
Excuse me?
Doesn't the court rule 464.6b contradict that?
I don't read that. What I do read that to say is that the redemption must occur in the action, which means, and that's what happened in this particular case.
It doesn't say in the action. It says until the entry of final judgment.
Until the entry of final judgment. Okay. Yes. And there is a. I would agree that if in fact there has to be a modification of what the appellate division gave, it can be and should be modified so that deadline date is final judgment. Because again, I do believe that one of the reasons that we are here where we are is because of the fact that the court in Kroniker was of the impression that the OST date was the deadline date. And the courts that after that case just simply followed that. And the reality is this court had an opportunity to review facts exactly like this in the Ornix case, Ornix versus Melton Kaufman. The facts were almost identical to this situation. The appellate division took a different, the trial court, using its discretion, made a determination that, in fact, this wasn't a case that a constructive trust should be applied. The appellate division took it from the perspective of, has there been an abuse of discretion? And the court goes and states, in this case, however, no abuse of discretion occurred when the judge allowed intervention. Although the timing was not initially in lockstep with the statutory scheme, Ammon's unsuccessful attempt to redeem and subsequent intervention were made during the time frame in which redemption was permissible. The redemption actually occurred after the court authorized intervention and redemption. Intervention allows for judicial oversight by the Chancery Court of the process and the proposed amount of consideration. Intervention is not designed to put the holder of a tax sale certificate on an inimmutable preferential position vis-a-vis redemption. That makes a lot of sense. And Mr. Greenberg is actually the attorney that was involved in that case, and he filed a petition for certification before this court. And this court ultimately elected not to grant certification in that situation. I take that, and maybe, I hope I'm not taking a presumption I didn't, that was an indication, at least I believe, that the court did not believe the determination in Oryx violated the spirit of Kroniker.
I might have misheard it. What you just read, didn't it say that the intervention motion happened first and then there was redemption? Or do I misunderstand what you
just
read?
Same exact circumstances as this one, Justice. What happened was they attempted to redeem.
Attempted.
They attempted to redeem. They got Mr. Greenberg did essentially what Mr. Bonci did in this case as well. He says, no, it should be barred. It barred redemption, and the court ultimately looked at all the facts in the case. Because at that point, they then went in and they filed a motion to intervene. The OST date hadn't passed, and therefore the facts are literally exactly the facts that are in this particular case. And in that court case, the appellate division ultimately says, we're going to look at it from the perspective of an abuse of discretion. We're going to see whether or not, based upon everything that the trial court knew, whether or not this is the type of situation where it's appropriate to give that second chance. And it was. And I do believe that it's appropriate.
There wasn't redemption that was completed. There was court action. And then ultimately the redemption was allowed? Or am I misunderstanding?
It was exactly the same as this circumstance. So what happened was Mr. Greenberg's client learned of the redemption, found out that they hadn't filed a motion to intervene. Mr. Greenberg, and Adam certainly will correct me if I'm wrong, indicated or expressed to the tax collector it should not be accepted because of the fact that they didn't file the motion to intervene. They then went, filed the motion to intervene. The trial court ultimately decided in that particular instance that the intervention should be permitted, notwithstanding the fact that they did not file the motion to intervene before that first attempt at redemption. So the circumstances are exactly, the facts are exactly the same. Plaintiff today focuses on a strict reading of Cronicker, the statutes, and the court rule, ignoring the purpose behind the amendment to NJSA 54:5-89.1, which is judicial oversight. We can't lose that important part. There needs to be judicial oversight. There's no dispute. You're not going to hear a dispute from me that the intervention must occur. Importantly, judicial oversight occurred in this case. In keeping with the spirit of Cronicker and other cases such as the unpublished Oryx decision, which had almost identical facts to the case to the facts in our case. Here the trial court and the appellate division focused on a judicial oversight aspect, as it should, in deciding not to impose a constructive trust for what can only be described as a procedural technicality in failing to first intervene. The appellate division also sought to establish a bright line rule as to when intervention must occur. The purpose behind the bright line rule is to allow the parties to tax foreclosure action to modify their behavior and set their expectations. Plaintiff and amicus, however, seek to muddy the water as to what the deadline should be and attempt to move the goalpost up to the filing of the complaint, which frankly I didn't understand. I'm going to confess I did not understand their argument, because it's almost as if they're suggesting, when do you have to intervene? Well, you have to intervene as soon as the complaint's filed. Well, that's not even possible in most instances. And frankly, you're not going to do that until you're actually in the transaction and you know that there's a foreclosure action pending. We're not disputing the fact that once that foreclosure complaint is filed, you must intervene. We're not disputing that. What we are saying is that if in fact the OST and more appropriately the final judgment has been entered, you shouldn't be precluded or barred merely because of the fact that you didn't do it right the first time, particularly when it was an innocent mistake. The Simon versus Cronicker decision, contrary to what was suggested, when they talked about the constructive trust, was only focusing on the particular party in that case, the Cherry Stone. So frankly, I read that to say that this doesn't, and in fact, the whole case dealt with a particular type of purchaser, the third party investor. And again, that was also defined as the air hunter and the intermeddler. But the court didn't decide what happens if you have something different than that. And again, there's different degrees. So ultimately, the court has to say, are we going to accept their interpretation, which is every single time you have a purchaser, regardless of how innocent they are, that we're going to impose a constructive trust if, in fact, they don't do it in lockstep with the proposed suggested way of doing this. In sum, plaintiff's proposed rule will punish innocent mistakes as much as bad acts, and this result should be avoided.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Collins. See you soon.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. The concern of the New Jersey Land Title Association is certainty and stability of titles. Stability of titles and certainty of title are necessary in order for the provision of title insurance. The availability of title insurance allows buyers to invest with confidence. That has a multiplier effect. It not only allows buyers to buy, but sellers to sell, lenders to lend, and builders to build. Now, New Jersey law requires intervention in a tax foreclosure sale, so the court can determine if the proposed buyer is offering a fair market price. It used to be more than nominal value, now it's fair market price. And the purpose of the court looking it over is just to make sure that an unscrupulous investor is not taking advantage of a distressed property owner. That's what happened here. There was a distressed property owner. A redemption buyer came in to buy the property. The property was sold for fair market value, and After the tax sale, certificate investors were paid off. The rest went to the property owner. If you follow their arguments, then the property owner isn't going to be able to be made at least partially whole in any way.
if there's any mistake whatsoever in trying to redeem a tax sale certificate, under their logic, well, oh, you can't do it now, so they get the property for their, you know, there's going to be their, what, I think it was $3,000 and some dollars for the investment and 20 some for the payoff at the interest rate. You know, that's the purpose of the tax sale certificate law. They help tax collectors by buying tax sale certificates. Their reward is getting interest up to 18%. Okay, over here we have the redemption buyers. The redemption buyers, they're looking for a property, maybe often as an investment, but they're not allowed to be unscrupulous. They're not allowed to rip people off because they have to go to court and have the court approve the sale. And under their interpretation, there's going to be, if they can't redeem because of an error, then they're going to get the windfall. And the Kroniker case explicitly mentioned, recognized the fact that the purpose of the tax sale certificate is for them to get their interest and getting a windfall from actually going to a foreclosure. That's a bonus. That's the exception to the rule. That's not what's supposed to happen in every case. So what happened here is redemption buyer buys a property, wants to redeem, and it's the title agent or the attorney who instead goes to the tax collector to pay them off. Tax collector says, no, you can't do that. You have to intervene. So they go to intervene. Since when does making a mistake be uncorrectable? If you try and serve a complaint on someone and you're unsuccessful, you could try again. No one stops you from that. If you make a motion that's denied without prejudice, you could make that motion again. The whole justice system isn't based on using technicalities to preclude justice. And they're just trying to follow a technicality that doesn't make sense. Now, Green Knight argues that the time for intervention is after the complaint is filed. But it seems to be what they construct after the complaint to be right after the complaint. All it has to be is
what he said. That's not what Mr. Bonsi said. I asked him that question, and he said there is no deadline other than the entry of final judgment. So maybe you're construing his papers to say that, but that's not what he said to us today.
Understood. But the point being that it's you have time to correct your mistakes. There should be no bright line rule. If you make a mistake in your redemption process, you automatically lose your shot. Okay? That's not the rule. And that's not the purpose of the justice system either. And as far as the New Jersey Land Title Association is, if they know, if there's going to be uncertainty as to title, wherein, for example, here they... The tax sale certificate purchaser, they're objecting to the intervention and sale of the property. Well, that property has already been insured, okay? And now it's like an immediate claim upon the title insurance company that just insured this sale. That was properly done, and it was proper intervention, and everyone was paid off. Policy of the tax sale law isn't just to help the municipalities. It's also to help the property owners. And that's what everyone seems to be forgetting. Under Green Knight's interpretation, the property owners are left out in the cold. No one's looking out for them. What happened here is what was supposed to happen, okay? Green Knight paid the tax collector, and after the sale, after the intervention, Green Knight got paid off, the tax collector was paid off, and the property owner was paid off. To find to the contrary would give an opportunity for property owners to get stripped of all equity based on a technicality and a misreading of Kroniker. And to the extent that there might be some unscrupulous investor trying to get over on a tax sale certificate investor, that can be resolved during the motion for intervention. And that's what that court has as their charge, to decide that. Intervention isn't guaranteed. Again, the interest of the National Land, New Jersey Land Title Association is stability of title. And if the ruling of it goes in favor of Green Knight, then they're going to be less interested in ensuring redemption buyers from buying distressed properties. And without title insurance and no one buying distressed properties that subject to a tax foreclosure sale, then who gets hurt? It's the property owners who will lose their equity. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pollan. Mr. Bonci, brief rebuttal. And as you're doing so, if you could at some point address what we've heard from your colleagues on this side of the aisle, that you got your investment back, you got the interest, you weren't harmed. How were you harmed?
Judge, I don't have a mortgage. I have a tax certificate. Case law is very clear, Barcelona in several cases. The expectation of a tax holder is not only interest, but the opportunity to get fee title. And they're just ignoring that aspect of it. Every time, you know, I've been doing this a long time, and it always comes to the point where they try to close themselves in the distressed property owner. They're telling you about some family moving across the country. Nothing in the remedy of constructive trust, nothing that we've ever argued, affects the ability of the seller to keep their money. They want to now argue they're arguing the position of the seller. When they sit there, and he used the term amicus, that they didn't pay fair market value for the property. They got a substantial discount because there was a foreclosure pending, because the stress of a foreclosure was governing it. That's why the motion is made. But let's talk about, he argues for stability. Let's talk about if we go to a subjective standard. We put Judge Fisher back in chancery. I'm going to argue that I want discovery. I don't know anything about this guy. We're talking about the sale of a property. Now I'm going to say, look, I want to know what they do. They're sending out 300 letters a week. I want to know how many properties they acquired, how sophisticated they are, and I'm going to be going into all this because now it's subjective, and I need to convince the general equity judge that they're not innocent. Well, I argued this thing back in 2006. Cherrystone Bay claimed they were helping the distressed property owner, that they were the good guys. The same exact things. They argued that they were innocent because they argued that the rules were not being enforced, and they should be rewarded for this. They even filed a motion for reconsideration on Malinowski versus Jacobs, where they argued saying this should only be applied prospectively because you put a new rule in, and the Supreme Court said, no, that's the same rule that's in there. We're enforcing it. So let's see what happens. We're going to be in months of discovery. We're not going to be able to sell the property. Properties normally sell in 60 days on a contract, somewhat worse. We're going to be sitting there arguing who these people are. And again, what we're dealing with is no indifference to Cherrystone. Cherrystone checked the foreclosure filings and located people. The respondent here sent out 300 letters to get people to call them because they knew they were in a foreclosure and they could get a good deal. There's no difference. They are exactly like Cherrystone. There's no difference at all. But the test that they're suggesting to you is not workable in the environment of selling property because we have to, as the plaintiff, we have to be able to figure out subjectively who they are. How do we do that without discovery? And then there's going to be facts in dispute, and the judge is going to have a plenary hearing in all these cases. Justice Alpin was correct.
What's wrong with that?
Pardon?
What's wrong with that?
That's
good. So there's a hearing.
You're going to have months.
And there's greater clarity than ever before.
Not going to be greater clarity. We're going to have confusion about people being able to sell property because we're going to be tied up in discovery. We're not going to be able to know by the settlement date. It's going to tie things up. You're going to have lots of cases going back and forth. And the question is, are you going to reward someone who violates the tax sale law by giving them the profit. That's what it's about. It isn't about, it's about here, they don't want to pay a title claim. It's about retaining the profit. It's never about the innocent person who's being foreclosed. It's not about them. It's between two commercial competitors. But I respectfully disagree with you, Judge Fisher, that that's going to benefit because we're going to end up killing the deal with discovery. The buyer's going to move on somewhere else.
Sounds like you're anxious to get me back in the trial court.
No. I was before you in the trial court. I was before you in the appellate division. I'm now before you in the Supreme Court, Justice. So, I mean, I've always been honored to appear before you, but I'm only using that as an example.
He's not going back to the trial court. Don't worry.
Sometimes on retirement they do, but it's really not a workable situation. And I see a lot of problems by going through a long process of knowing where's the rule. I mean, there's been certainty since the Supreme Court decisions in 2007. If you follow the procedure, things are certain. And the trying to put fear in you that title companies won't insure, they insure all the time. All they want is an email from me saying I will accept the redemption. And they're fine. If they want a consent order, we give them consent order. If we disagree, we make a motion before the judge. But this is a third, this is a, what we call the title raider, what Justice Albin called a third-party investor, someone who sees someone's being foreclosed, tracks them down, and tries to take advantage of the situation, knowing that they can get something at a very good bargain.
Mr. Gonci, is there any particular point or points you want to make in response, and then we'll close out rebuttal, please?
Well, I was responding to those points. Was there?
A little bit more clipped, I was suggesting.
Okay, please. I'm going to finish up.
Thank you.
In conclusion, I'm just going to say, I don't think it's good to return to the Wild West where people have no penalty for violating the tax sale law. And when they're caught, they say, what do I have to lose? We're going to have all kinds of things that we never know about because we don't catch them all. And we do look at redemptions. There's no question about it, but we don't catch them all. So for those reasons, I think Justice Albin got it right in Simon versus Kroniker, Simon versus Rando, Malinowski versus Jacobs. I think his opinion is well-reasoned, and for all those reasons, I respectfully request that you continue that. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you live.
Thank you, Mr. Bonci. Thank you to all counsel. We'll take the